It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. And is it all right if I call you boss?
I prefer TJ.
TJ, okay. Well,
in 2007, Crosby Kemper III interviewed the infamous political boss, Tom Pendergast.
And we all want to know, what did you do with the bodies?
I don't know anything about bodies.
Okay, actually, it was local scholar Bill Worley acting as Tom Pendergast. The hour-long interview earned the Kansas City Public Library a regional Emmy nomination and launched a regular event called Meet the Past, in which Kemper, the library's executive director, interviews prominent figures from history. This interview with Boss Tom brought Kansas City history alive, but it also got a little personal.
He wrote a letter to my great uncle, or to the judge, actually, referring to my great uncle, saying that you were not in good health as you were languishing there in Leavenworth, and that you identified my great uncle James Kemper as potentially your parole officer. It was a great moment in our family history.
I trusted your uncle.
Yeah, and we appreciated that.
Well, of course it got personal. Kemper, like Pendergast, is a name to know in Kansas City's history. James the parole officer was far from the most consequential or prominent of the Kempers. What's it like to grow up as one? And what's it like to make a name of one's own? I'm Brian Ellison. Today, Crosby Kemper III is playing himself in one of our portrait sessions here on KCUR's Central Standard. Crosby, welcome.
Thanks, Brian.
It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So what do you remember knowing about the Kemper family name when you were growing up?
Well, I was not aware of any kind of big distinction until there was a family drama that made the front pages of newspapers around the country. My aunt's ex-husband kidnapped my cousin, was arrested by the FBI in the New Orleans airport, and that all happened on my 9th birthday. And it turned out that was more important in the family than my 9th birthday.
Huh. So, which you probably felt terrible about.
Yeah, well, it wasn't my best birthday, though. It was pretty exciting in a way. Then I realized there was something a little different anyway.
Over time, you must have come to appreciate what some of those differences were.
Well, I guess so. I mean, you know, I do come from a family that has money, and I do come from a family that's been very prominent in civic affairs, political affairs, in some cases national affairs of those kinds, and so you know, it's an interesting thing. It's also, you know, it has positives and negatives. So you hang out with some interesting people growing up. There are high expectations. There are a lot of assumptions that are made, and in my case, my father was achieved by the end of his life a kind of legendary status, deserved in many ways. He was a great man, and so you have that to deal with.
I want to talk. We'll talk about your father in a little bit, especially as it intersected with your own professional career. But I want to come back. You said you met with interesting people. It opened up some of these odd conversations. Who do you remember meeting when you were a kid?
Oh, you know. So my father was very involved in the draft Goldwater movement. Barry Goldwater, particularly after President Kennedy died, who was a close friend of his, didn't really want to run in 64. And my father was part of the group, famous hotel room in Chicago, where they met to draft Goldwater. And he was involved in that. So I met a lot of those people and Barry Goldwater and President Nixon, various people along the way, particularly in Republican politics, that were pretty interesting. And so you grow up in that kind of an atmosphere, and it does have interest.
You also said a moment ago that there were expectations that came with that. What expectations do you remember feeling being placed on you?
Well, you're expected to play a role in the larger world. I think that's the first thing. You're expected to be successful. There are high expectations in whatever endeavor you attempt that you should. You should succeed. Do your best. You know, and I would say, you know, I also want to mention my mother in this context. You know, she started the Performing Arts Foundation in Kansas City and brought people like Virgil Thompson back to Kansas City for the first time. Performances, Evelyn Lear in the American premiere of Handel's Julius Caesar, et cetera. You know, so she was a pretty phenomenal person to be around from the point of view of the arts and literature. But I think the expectations is always that whatever you do, whatever endeavor, A, you'll do your best, and B, you should probably expect to succeed.
You also said that people made assumptions based on the fact that you were a Kemper.
Well, they assume that you are wealthy. They assume, you know, and they assume, you know, I'm certainly better off than a majority of people. But they assume great wealth with vast resources. They assume power. You know, I'm always amused by that in the context of Kansas City. They also assume that you have knowledge of insider things that you may or may not have.
You mentioned your father. He died 2.5 years ago.
Right.
What was he like when you were growing up?
Well, he was larger than life, literally larger. He was 6'7.5". Kansas City made some big people in those days: John Latshaw, Dutton Brookfield, my father, and he had a booming deep voice, and he had very high standards, and he was always active, and he was always considering things from the point of view of some principles, some very high principles, some more. Like George Washington's rules of civility, you know, mm-hmm. You know how you sitting up straight. In fact, I'm thinking maybe I should sit up straighter right now, thinking about that. And so he was a taskmaster, but he was also a great and loving father. I had a great childhood. My parents were great, great parents when I was a child. They were very engaged with us. And presented a life that was full of possibility.
A lot of successful business people, as your father was, do not always have time for their families and children. That's not the family life that their family experienced.
He loved being around kids. I think he had my grandparents. His parents were not; they weren't children oriented. I can remember my grandfather. Didn't particularly want to be around me until I learned to throw football. But when I could throw a forward pass in a spiral, at that point he was willing to participate with me. I think my father grew up in a relatively cold environment from his distant environment, cold maybe too strong, distant environment with his parents, and he wanted something different with his kids.
So as you think back, are there stories or is there a particular event that sort of captures who your dad was from your childhood period?
Oh, I don't know. You know, that's a great question. There's so many stories about my father. I do remember his getting very upset with President Nixon in the White House and lecturing Mrs. Nixon because President Nixon had come to Kansas City to fundraiser for Jack Danforth and didn't show up at the fundraiser claiming to be sick, and then went to the police chief's convention that was going on in Kansas City, and he went off into the crowd on his way to the convention hall to speak to the police chiefs. And my father said, well, you know, if he's well enough to do that, and there was some security concern too, you know, he could have come to our deal. So he was invited to the White House. I went with him, and he ended up lecturing Mrs. Nixon in front of the guy who was head of Gillette, I think. And I thought, well, that's pretty bold.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, being connected to political figures was one aspect, but being a business leader in Kansas City, he had connections with celebrities and sports figures as well. I'm sure you enjoyed those connections as a kid.
One of the best stories of his is about Charlie Finley. So Charlie Finley buys the A's, right? And he shows up, and my father's seated next to him at the Chamber of Commerce lunch to celebrate that. And just an idle conversation, he said, Charlie, I assume you've got the team financed. And Charlie Finley said to him, no, I don't. And Dad said, well, do you need a loan? He said, yeah, I need $5 million. I bought the team for $5 million. I need to borrow. So actually, we worked that out. And then a story that my father waited until many, many years after I had started my banking career to tell me, my grandfather was looking over the loan documents and said, you've got the wrong collateral. This is the wrong company. Charlie had about a dozen companies with the same name, more or less. And so he made my father drive all night to Charlie's Indiana farm to get his signature in the right collateral, which he did. and so he told me that story many, many years later. But there are lots of Charlie Finley stories. We've got Nancy Finley, his niece, is going to be in the library next month talking about Finley Ball. But Charlie used to show up in our driveway at 2 a.m. To vent about the Kansas City Star and Kansas City media generally and how they treated him. And I remember my father going out in his bathrobe and sitting in Charlie's car at 2 a.m. to hear this.
That's full-service banking right there.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So one experience you had that perhaps was not typical of many kids is you went off to boarding school.
Yeah.
You went to Andover.
I went to Andover, the boarding school in Massachusetts. My daughter, my 18-year-old daughter, Madeline, who's now calling herself Crosby the Fourth as her pen name, she just graduated. Yeah.
And that's a long way from home, geographically as well as perhaps metaphorically.
Yeah. My father donated a building to Andover in 1962 when I was 11, and I went with him to the ceremonies, my mother. And I loved the campus. It's the most beautiful campus. And I love the idea of boys, and at that point, all boys. Now it's co-ed, but from all over the country, indeed all over the world, coming together in this beautiful spot. It seemed very platonic, and it was. It was a great experience for me.
He donated a building before you got there.
Before I got
was
there,
was it
yeah.
named for him? Was it Kemper Hall?
It was named after my great-grandfather.
Okay.
And so I had a friend named Whit Klein who in the locker room, there was a guy named, I think his name was Bobby Copley, Copley Newspapers. Hmm. And so he introduced me. He said, Crosby, come over here and introduce yourself to this guy. So he said, Bobby Copley Newspapers, here's Crosby Kemper Auditorium.
That's good to be known by your buildings. That must have changed the dynamic, though, as a student at the school.
Yeah, well,
or
really,
maybe not at Andover.
What really changed the dynamic was the headmaster was in those days was a guy named John Kemper, who was a very distant cousin. But he used to, in assemblies, I was the president of my class for a while and stuff like that, and very involved as the chairman of the prom committee. And John Kemper would call me up to the assembly and refer to me as Cousin Cros, which, of course, you know, everybody made fun of that.
Yeah, help your social standing.
It didn't help my standing at all, yeah.
And so you went on from there to spend a year at Eton in England.
Yeah, the famous boarding school in England where I wore a tailcoat and white tie and striped trousers to school every day, which was kind of amusing.
Was it enjoyable?
I had a great time. I was the oldest boy in school at that point. They start school a little bit earlier, and I was, you know, a year beyond high school at that point. And so I had a little bit of special privilege because of that. But I had very interesting friends. One of my friends is head of furniture at Christie's in London. One is a judge in England. One of them ran the London Times, et cetera. So very interesting people and a lot of history. I sat at a desk in which the initials had been carved of two future prime ministers, et cetera. Wow. So, yeah, it was a very interesting experience.
And how did all of those experiences, fairly unique among 18, 19-year-olds, how did those shape who you became?
Well, I think there are a lot of things about it. First of all, I've always been interested in history and interested in the world, something that comes from both of my parents. And so it enriched that direction. I've been something of an Anglophile and interested in British history in particular. Certainly Eton helped that. Andover opened a big intellectual world to me. I had some really great teachers and some really great friends who are intellectually engaged and interesting people who've gone on to do interesting things in the world. A larger world, opening up a larger world, and it leads probably to my being a librarian today and doing the things that we do at the library, which is that I'm trying to communicate that sense of the richness of the world through our library programming, through what the library does with kids and teens.
You ended up at Yale College next. You studied mm-hmm. history. I have to think that is an extension of that continued interest in the broader world.
Yeah, I had truly great teachers at Yale. Robin Winks, who was sort of my mentor, who's a great historian of British Empire, but also became the first, I think, a great historian of the National Parks System, was chairman of the National Parks Board, a great man. I got to travel with him to some of the national parks, and it was an extraordinary experience. David Brian Davis, the great historian of anti-slavery, Edmund Morgan, Yaroslav Pelikan, the great historian of Christian doctrine. I had phenomenal teachers, Harold Bloom, who became a friend, who is still a friend in later life. The great literary critic. It was a phenomenally rich environment. I mean, I'm really grateful. I think one of the most important things that one can do in one's life is to feel and express the gratitude for the great things that have come your way. And I'm really lucky in my education, both from my parents, from my friends, and from the schools that I've been to.
Well, and as you then, so you travel the country and the world to get your education, I wonder, how was your relationship with your family and this iconic Kansas City family changing during that time?
Well, you know, interesting family dynamics, late 60s, growth of counterculture, feminism, et cetera. My mother became a great feminist. My father was building a company. That didn't match. They got divorced. The influences of both were very strong. My father was not a happy person, I think, for a while. And our relationship was fairly rocky, and my mother becoming for a little while, a kind of extreme feminist. That was an interesting moment for a young conservative as I was. So I had things changed in the family dynamic over that time. And when I came back to Kansas City and went to work for the bank and I ran for the legislature, my father was disappointed that I wasn't totally devoted to the bank. My mother was disappointed that I was still a conservative Republican when she'd become a fairly liberal feminist. So my relations with the family changed a lot.
In those early years after college, you worked some for the bank, but you did some other things too, right?
Well, I was trying to write, and I ran for the legislature. After my first disagreement with my father, which led to leaving the bank, I went off to China and taught English in China. And when I came back with my first wife, Kate, who was from a New York family, actually a New Yorker family. Her father was a writer for The New Yorker. We lived in New York, and we lived on the Columbia campus for a while. She was getting a master's degree. I worked in a bookstore, So, completely different kind of life and lifestyle and place, and another learning experience. I look at everything that's happened to me in my life and everything that I've done and the places I've been, the different jobs I've held, from being a T-shirt salesman and a bookstore salesman to being the CEO of a banking company, as a part of a journey and a learning experience, and try and absorb and learn.
Well, let's explore how that journey unfolded from living in New York, from teaching English in China, to eventually becoming CEO of that bank. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Crosby Kemper III and find out how he got there and then why he moved on. I'm Brian Ellison. KCUR Central Standard returns in a moment. Don't go away. It's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison here with Crosby Kemper III for our portrait session on this Friday morning. We've been talking about his childhood and his early adulthood growing up with Kansas City's most famous names, but there came a time where he would have to grow into that identity, and he did get his turn eventually as the CEO of the bank his family founded. Crosby, you worked on again, off again, and then in 2000 you became CEO of UMB Bank. How did that come to be?
Well, that's an interesting story, because my brother Sandy was slated to be the CEO, as the CEO of the bank, the big bank, and was actually functioning as the CEO. His dad was getting older.
Your younger brother, Sandy.
He's my younger brother, and I'd been out of the bank for a while, and also he was doing a great job. And so anyway, he was slated to be the CEO, and he had started, with some help from me, an internet company inside the bank, eScout, and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs came to him and said, "We can take this public," and, you know, billions of dollars. They were talking literally billions of dollars, and but you have to be, they're saying to Sandy, you have to be the CEO. And so my father and Sandy called me one day and said, "Sandy's got to go run this company. You need to come back from St. Louis," where I was president of UMB in St. Louis. You have to come back to be the CEO. And I went home and talked to my wife and children about it, and they thought it was a great idea. And so I came back to Kansas City to be the CEO, very unexpectedly.
Was that a moment you'd dreamed of, that someday you would get to be the CEO?
When I was younger, I thought when there were just the first three, my mother's children with my father, and I was the oldest and I was the boy, I thought it was inevitable. So I thought about it, of course. And then as I got older and I was interested in politics and interested in writing and interested in history, I thought maybe this won't happen or maybe I can do both. And then Second Family came along. I came back to the bank for a while, left the bank. I lost that dream. So actually, it was a little bit of a surprise, and it was also kind of a rocky road for a lot of reasons. My father was never really retired from the bank. I mean, finally, at the very end, with my younger brother Mariner, I think he was unable to be involved. His strength was waning. But while I was there, technically, he was retired, and he was in my office every day. Or I was in his office every day, and that was difficult. Also, 9/11 happened, and it had an effect on the bank, and we had to buy a company in Milwaukee, and it was a very interesting time, but I will say very stressful.
It doesn't sound like you remember it very positively.
No, I remember the banking business very positively because it's very much the way we've always done it, both sides of the Kemper family, a very much a people and a community oriented. Thing. And so I feel very positive about big parts of it. It didn't help my relationship with my father. I will say that. It was a very rocky road with my father, and that was the most difficult thing. And so I left the bank after four years of doing that.
You left the bank to save your relationship with your father?
Well, no, it didn't save the relationship with my father. It was part of the decline of the relationship with my father and troubles in the family. But I thought I also had a positive direction I thought I was going in. I had been offered a job as president of a university, and I thought that was an ideal kind of job for my talents. Unfortunately, the university didn't actually withdraw the offer. They just stopped returning my phone calls because the previous president had been in the ICU, not expected to survive, and he walked out one day, and they stopped returning my phone calls. So I was left there, and I had talked to members of the library board a couple of times. They'd come to me offering me the job at the library because let go the previous incumbent, and they needed somebody. So about the third time, I said, "Okay, as an interim, I'll do it. I'll do it for 6 months and solve some of the financial problems that the library thought it had, which it didn't really." And I turned out A. It turned out not to have the opposite of financial problems at that point. We had some money left over from the capital campaign the Kauffman Foundation had given us. And we were able to use that for programming. The board agreed, and Kauffman Foundation, Tom McDonald, then the chair, and Carl Schramm, then the CEO, agreed that we could use it for the programming that we started. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be a great thing, and I turned out to really enjoy the people I was working with and thought I could do something for the community.
To wrap up the conversation about the bank, your younger brother, you mentioned Mariner, runs UMB now. What you mentioned, the family relationship became conflicted. Has that changed over the years? Has it improved? Are you still in touch with the family?
So my relationship with the family has improved pretty dramatically over the last few years, and it's pretty good. Mariner and I have a good relationship. He's doing a brilliant job at the bank. And as a shareholder, I'm glad of that. Also as his brother. So I have a pretty good relationship with most of my family members. My relationship with my father in the last year of his life was repaired, and we spent a lot of great time together. I had a great time with him in the last year, which was good. Best time actually as an adult with him. So.
After you left the bank, as you say, you got involved with the library. You started as an interim director there, eventually became the director. It's not hard hearing you talk about your background, what drew you to that work as a librarian, but you didn't actually have experience as a librarian.
No, I had a lot of experience with books. I'd read a lot of them, and I love reading, and I love books, and I love the life of the mind, and but yeah, I had no experience as a librarian. In fact, we had to change the state law for me to become the permanent librarian, which is a story in and of itself, because I managed to not ingratiate myself with everybody in the legislature in the way I went about it, unfortunately, just stupidity on my part. But anyway, eventually we did get the law
changed.
The
state law required you to have
An MLS, Master of Library Science or Management degree, and I didn't have either, so... It was interesting that no other library job in the state required that. St. Louis Library did not require that, for instance, but somehow it had gotten into the law about the Kansas City Library. So anyway, we did change the law, so I was able to become the permanent director.
And you mentioned that you had this love of books. Tell me about that love of books. What kind of books?
Well, first of all, both of my parents were great readers, and our discussions at dinner when I was growing up tended to revolve around books and take us to the encyclopedia or things in my mother and father's library to settle arguments. That I've always loved history. I also from around the age of 14 started to be interested in political philosophy and philosophy generally. And I've always read widely in other areas, pretty much anything of interest to human beings. But particularly history and political philosophy are the things that I, you know, in the middle of the night, if I reach for a book, you know, that and a really good thriller, a Lee Child thriller.
You know. You have a lot of books?
Probably about 25,000 books.
25,000 books.
Yeah. The people at my apartment building, Jeff Crum owns my building, and Adam Jones, they are worried about the collapse of the floors.
Wait, these are all in your home, all of these books?
Well, a lot of them are in my home. Some of them are in my office and in the conference room next door. I think they're, you know, the people who come into my conference room are also worried about the collapse of the bookshelves on top of them. But,
are they stacked double deep?
They're double, sometimes triple deep, yeah, which, you know, librarians are horrified by.
Right.
Yeah, they come into my personal library and they shudder.
So what's your favorite book of the 25,000?
Oh my God, my favorite book. I don't think I have a favorite book.
Oh, come on, there must be one.
There's some books that I go back to over and over again. I mean, I love Dickens and, you know, David Copperfield and Great Expectations. I've always loved Evelyn Waugh, the English satirical novelist. I read in Plato, and I read in Shakespeare regularly. I go back to the Republic and other Platonic dialogues regularly. Harold and the Purple Crayon, I like to say, was my first love as a book. My children got tired of my reading it to them. I was still reading it to them when they were 11 and 12. And they said, Dad, it's time to stop Harold and the Purple Crayon.
I've heard from one of our colleagues here that you've been known to do dramatic readings of James Joyce in public settings.
Well, you know, Tom Shawver and his merry group of Irish banditti, Bloomsbury Books, he started putting on, which is done around the country, and I'd done this in St. Louis as well, these 24-hour readings of Ulysses on Bloomsday, the day that Ulysses takes place. It was also the day that he first walked out with his wife, Nora. And I put on my phony Irish accent with the best of them, and I'm a complete ham. I like to say I'm a completely uncured Missouri ham.
Yeah. I mean, do you think of yourself, in addition to telling other stories, do you think of yourself as a storyteller?
I think a storyteller, yeah, and somebody who likes to entertain in an enlightening way. I think that's part of what we do at the library is we bring people in because they know they will have some fun, there will be a good time, and they learn something as well. I think if you can combine those two things, and you know, I've done my job.
That work at the library you talk about, you feel like you've taken it a different direction than maybe your predecessors.
Well, I think we've done three things at the library, and all these things were underway in the library. It's not that they weren't being done before, but I think partly because of relationship with Kaufman, partly a relationship with the civic community, we're able to play a civic role on civic issues. I think the concentration on reading, the understanding, the importance of reading, I think the library is a leader in that in the library world and in the community. And then recently, I think the question of the digital divide, the library is the place where people cross the digital divide. We're the 25% of our population that doesn't have access to the internet for one reason or another. They come to the library, and we provide not only access, but we provide skills. We provide help with jobs and health and wellness and all kinds of things. And that's a mission of the library. And I think we've done in our library, and it's not just me, I think I've provided some leadership, but we've got an incredible staff and people who are leaders nationally, people on our staff who are leaders in their areas nationally. And we're making a huge difference, I think.
Another part of why I've heard you say you were hired at the library is your connections to the philanthropic community as well. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's something you enjoy, the fundraising, the bringing in other outside supporters?
You know, we've done a pretty good job of fundraising, particularly with the foundations in town, the foundations, Kaufman, the Hall Family Foundation, the Community Foundation, the Soslins, et cetera. They get what we're doing. And I've had less success with the corporate community. In fact, with the corporate community, the library is somewhat at odds because they're taking our money and funding tax increment financing, tax abatements, and tax diversions, where money from the library and the school district is flowing to them. And I've stood up against that, and it's made a lot of people in the corporate community mad at the library.
And I do want to talk, especially in our next segment, a little bit about those sort of those political conversations that you have found yourself part of. But before we leave library, I want to ask about one other door that the library opened up to you. You met a woman through your work at the library with whom you fell in love.
Yeah, it's true. I read a book, you know, it's probably 14, 15 years ago now, called Ornament of the World, how Jews, Muslims, and Christians created a culture of tolerance in medieval Spain, by a woman named Maria Rosa Menocal. And she was a professor at Yale. And when I became a librarian, one of the first things I did was send her an email saying, would you come to Kansas City and speak about the book? And she ultimately did. It took a while to get that done. She didn't really understand where Missouri was, where Kansas City was. She thought it was close to where her son, Harry, my stepson Harry, was graduating from college, Earlham College in Indiana. She thought the two were close. So
well,
she organized a trip around that. And she came to Kansas City, and she had just written a book about Moorish architecture and medieval Spain and art and architecture and the melding of cultures, Islamic cultures and Western cultures and Jewish cultures, Christian cultures and Jewish cultures. And she found the plaza a hoot, the Giralda Tower and whatnot. She thought that was really great. She had a great sense of humor. Anyway, we hit it off, and ultimately we got married. And she actually, before she died, right before she died, unfortunately, she moved to Kansas City. She was the head of the Whitney Humanities Center at Yale, held the Sterling Professorship at Yale, which is the highest honor at Yale, and had written these great books about medieval literature. And she came to Kansas City to live in the crossroads with me.
No, she died only 15 months after you were married.
Right. We were together for 22 months, short but great period of my life.
One of the stories I love that I've heard about that is that you wooed her with barbecue, seems like a great way
to meet someone. So the story of her coming is Henry Fortunato, who's in our director of public affairs, wouldn't pay for business class travel. And she had gotten to the stage where she'd been traveling for the book that was the only bestseller in medieval literature and history. and so she was establishing that as a have to have. And we would do it. So she called me up and she said, look, I'm having a hard time with this guy, Henry. So you just write me a check, but for whatever you want to do, and I'll come. But you have to promise to take me to Arthur Bryant's, because she knew Calvin Trill. You know, he was a Yale trustee, and she'd read about Kansas City food, so she wanted to go to Arthur Bryant's. So the three successful things I did with her to court her were to take her to Arthur Bryant's, I took her to Oklahoma Joe's, and I took her to Lulu's, and she said, "I must be a good guy." Those were the three eateries.
It sealed the deal.
Sealed the deal.
Well, that's great. Well, Casey, our Central Standard needs to take one more break, but when we come back, we'll talk more with Crosby Kemper III about some of his other projects, including his frequent forays into conservative, libertarian politics. We talk about the life of a city, too, and its leadership. That's all ahead in just a minute. I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're getting to know Crosby Kemper III today on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. And Crosby, I want to talk a little bit about Kansas City, not just because you're a Kemper, but that may be part of it. I think people look to you as someone who is a civic leader, or who could be, or who should be. Do you think of yourself as a civic leader?
I think of myself as somebody who loves the city. I think Kansas City is a wonderful place, and I grew up here, and it's my home. My father was definitely a civic leader. I don't know if I am or not. I don't know if people see me that way. I think other people have to believe it for it to be true. I know I've never been a member of the civic council, or they've never asked me, and I don't. You know, I'm not invited to a lot of those parties, and part of that is because of the stand that I take on some issues in town. That, you know, I'm seen as sort of the angry curmudgeon by other people. I think of myself as a realist, and I think of myself as the only person in the civic community. My cousin Jonathan sometimes, I think, does, and one or two other people, but who actually is analytical about the issues that the city faces, is willing to be a true realist.
A realist as opposed to an idealist? Is that...
I think to be a successful idealist, I think I'm an idealist. I believe that there are things we should always work toward. We need to work towards harmony in the world. There's a lot of disharmony this year in particular, and I think we need to work toward it. And I'm an idealist about the possibility of that happening. But I also think you have to be realistic about what is actually happening, about what the city actually does. And then you have to be purposeful and intentional about taking the realities and turning them into something better that heads towards the ideal.
You said you've never been invited to things like the Civic Council. Do you resent that?
No, I don't resent it. Actually, I have more time to read, so I'm happy about that. I think the lack of inclusiveness in the city, the fact that there tends to be an insider baseball game that is played by a relatively small group of people, has harmed the city. I don't think the exclusiveness of that those groups is intentional, and I think many of the civic leadership are very good people when they're at home, but I think that there's been an inertial thing that has happened that's walled the civic community off from a lot of the realities of the city. And part of that is the state line. The civic community tends to be off in Johnson County in their enclaves, and I think the civic groups have become enclaves too.
So what in your mind then would true or effective or positive civic leadership look like?
Well, I think, first of all, we ought to be concerned about the way the city, and there are two different versions of the city. There's the metro area, which has got a huge problem with the border wars, where we're playing games with the taxpayers' money that people around the country make fun of now. And then there's the city of Kansas City, Missouri, still our largest political entity, and the way it's run, you know, the turnout in mayoral elections, school board elections, has become tiny. You know, the willingness of people, of civic level folks, to be engaged in issues that revolve around poverty or race, or just the structure of taxes. We have a very regressive tax system in Kansas City, Missouri. Very regressive, among the most regressive in the United States. And you hear nobody in the civic community talking about that. I'm a conservative, libertarian-oriented Republican, and here I am, the only person in town talking about our regressive tax system.
And you've not been afraid to say that, to talk about those things. You've even in a a quasi-public role at the Kansas City Public Library, mm-hmm. you have not been afraid to jump into politics.
Well, I'll say two things about that. First of all, in my role as a librarian, I believe that I need to present all legitimate, we can define legitimate, points of view, left, right, and center, and we do that. We have a great dialogue. If you look at our August calendar, it's we're presenting mostly people I wouldn't always agree with, and we do a lot of that. So we have a broad dialogue going on in the library. In my political position, and sometimes I take it as a librarian because the library suffers from a lot of this, as the school district does, the mental health board does, the developmentally disabled, the blind pension, the city diverting, city of Kansas City diverts more money from the average taxpayer to the corporate community than any other city in the United States. It's an extraordinary amount of money that we're subsidizing corporations, mostly with real estate. It has no good effect for jobs. But as a librarian, it's hurting the library. The city takes $3 million a year from the library that the voters have voted to the library. Take $30 million from the school district, which, by the way, would pay for universal, high-quality early childhood education for every child in the school district.
People who disagree with you would say, yes, it takes some money away from the library, but it's creating other things that are in the public interest, things like the streetcar, things like development of these neighborhoods that were previously run down or unoccupied.
Sure. And a certain amount of that the library has supported, and I've supported, but we've gone overboard. We're doing more of this than anybody else, and the people who are getting the money are people who could be doing this on their own. You take the Convention Center Hotel. My father, Irv Hockaday, and others raised money from the corporate community to make the Convention Center Hotel, now the Marriott, in 1985 happen. Now, the city takes money from the library and the school district, the mental health board, et cetera, to make a convention center hotel happen, even though I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen anyway, but they're going to take money from us. I like the old way better, where corporations and wealthy people gave back to the community. Our way now is they take from the community. And yeah, there's been a certain amount of building that wouldn't have happened, a small amount. Most of this would have happened anyway. The Crossroads, as an example, where I live, was a go-and-gussie before they started throwing tax credits at it. It was created because of the great movement of artists, gallery owners, et cetera, for the creation of First Friday, and all that. Restaurants started to pop up, and they weren't getting tax subsidies.
So how has your upbringing, your background, how has that shaped these political views?
My father and mother both believed in giving back. They believed it, my mother lost her faith, but as Christians, but they believed it civically. They believed it because they were brought up that way, that to whom much is given, much is expected. And so I learned about that. And I also learned from, people like Henry Block or Morton Soslin, Paul Henson, the people in this community of an earlier generation, Don Hall and Joyce Hall, who made a lot of money and made sure they gave a lot of it back. And now we've got a lot of people who think that maybe they should take some money from the library and school district to make even a little bit more money.
A few years back, a little more than a decade ago, I guess, you co-founded with Rex Sinkfield the Show Me Institute.
Right.
I've heard that described in shorthand as a libertarian think tank. Is that a fair description?
Well, we call it a free market think tank, and you call it a lot of things. And we have some internal disagreements about what's the most important thing. Rex is an efficient markets theorist. He invented the index fund. I think efficient markets theorists are right in the long run, but sometimes not right in the short run. They don't see the friction in the economy or occasional irrationalities in the economy. But we believe that there are free market solutions to a lot of problems that people on the left and some people in the center and a lot of people locally think are best handled by government. And I also firmly believe, and I think it's a general libertarian belief, that the simplicity and fairness of a tax system is really important. And in Missouri and in Kansas City, we have the most complex and very unfair tax system.
Yeah, I hear you talking a lot about sort of ideas and the words and the ideas that can shape the city's values and the city's direction. Your colleague at the Show Me Institute, Rex Sinkfield, has a has a reputation for using money to influence politics in Missouri without any limits on campaign contributions. He gives a fairly significant amount of money to political campaigns. Do you have a problem with that?
Well, I don't have a problem with Rex spending his money the way he wants to, as I don't, you know, with George Soros or Tom Steyer or people on the left who do that. Rex's decisions on spending his personal money are not always decisions that I would completely agree with. I know he's irritated people. He didn't ask me about the earnings tax that are having the earnings tax election every 5 years, and he's irritated people with that. But I want to say this about Rex, and particularly in Kansas City, the media, particularly the Star, but the media generally, have been very unfair to Rex. Rex is a man of ideas. He's a serious devout Catholic who's giving back most of his money, grew up in an orphanage, he's published a book that's a very interesting, intelligent look at economics, particularly at the state level, that nobody's managed to review in Kansas City. They're not interested in his ideas. They're just interested in the way he spends his money. And that's deeply unfair. He is a man of great principle, you know, it's interesting that if you talk about local issues, things like the streetcar, the airport, or the tax increment financing, I find the two people I agree with the most are my friend Jim Nutter, who is probably the most consistent supporter of Democratic candidates, liberal Democratic candidates in Missouri and nationally, and Rex. Because what both Jim and Rex are interested in and I'm interested in something that's universal, fair, simple, explainable, and if we're going to help anybody, we should be helping the poor, and particularly the working poor. And if you designed a system to harm the working poor, you design a system a lot like what we have in Kansas City.
Are there any ways you would distinguish yourself from Rex in terms of either the kinds of positions you support or the way you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, one thing where I disagree with Rex and some of our analysts and whatnot at Show Me is that they would like statewide solutions to educational issues, and then in Rex's case specifically, he's willing to use the ballot box at the state level to control things at the local level, and I don't actually agree with that philosophically. I think the earnings tax should be a local question. I think the earnings tax is a flat tax from dollar one. It's something that Ted Cruz, Steve Forbes, and Paul Ryan would say is too regressive, but in Kansas City, the civic community, this is where I'm stunned at the civic council. I'm stunned at the city council with a bunch of good liberal Democrats endorsing and using as a primary funding mechanism a flat tax from dollar one, the most regressive tax there is. So I don't agree with the way Rex goes about it, but philosophically on things like the earnings tax or the streetcar, I very much agree with him. I have to insist, the one thing I want everyone to know about Rex Singfield is what a good human being he is, thoughtful, kind, generous human being. He is not, you know, the Star has treated him as such an evil person, and it's really deeply unfair. They should be ashamed of themselves.
You know, you mentioned kindness, you mentioned goodness as sort of these centering values that you admired not mm-hmm. only in him, but I think you're lifting up as yeah. things you aspire to yeah. as well. What are the ways next for you that you would want to live those things out? Have you found the perfect job as director of the library? Is this where you want to be?
Well, it's pretty much my last job. I think I'm 65, and I want to keep doing this for some time. I'm on a mission at this point. Taxing jurisdictions, the library, the school district, a lot of other school districts, and the NAACP, and teachers union, et cetera. We've written a letter to the Civic Council and the Chamber and the Downtown Council saying we need to come before you and explain how you are harming the children of this city with your tax policies. And so I have a mission for the next 5 years, which I do want to broadcast to the community. We need to reverse that. Kansas City is doing things that harm children. And our vision of ourselves is that we're a place that's great for children. Okay, put your money where your mouth is. Stop taking money from the library and the school district.
And do you see that crusade, that mission, as you said, as an extension of your family's mission through the generations, or do you see that as a new direction that you want to be taking?
I think my father always believed in helping people. Sometimes got him in trouble. He always believed in helping people who couldn't help themselves. I remember Judge Sachs once reading him the Riot Act in a lawsuit where he was trying to defend two older ladies who were stockholders in a small bank in northwestern Missouri whom he thought were being taken advantage of. And Judge Sachs said, Crosby, you should listen to your lawyers more. But he wasn't a guy who listened to lawyers. He listened to his heart.
Well, I want to thank Crosby Kemper III for being with us for this portrait session today. It's been good to get to know you more. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
That portrait can also be found online, including the telling of this story, along with photographs by Paul Andrews. All that and audio of today's show will be online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. All our past shows are there, too. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. And I'm at PTS Brian. On Mondays this summer, KCUR is giving you a chance to enjoy some special programming at 10 a.m. and give us your feedback. This Monday, we'll bring you the pop culture program Bullseye. Central Standard will return on Tuesday when we find out how St. Joseph, Missouri is getting ready for a total eclipse of the sun next year. They're expecting 500,000 people in town. Really? Listen for that. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and Fridays by Jen Chen. Our team also includes Suzanne Hogan and Andrea Tudhope. Our intern is Anna Sterla. Linda Scher is our announcer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman's on leave, so I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, everybody.